If you turn to the book of Hosea, Hosea chapter 11, which will be our starting point for this morning, Hosea chapter 11. In the opening three chapters of this book of Hosea, Hosea sets forth his own autobiography. And he explains in these opening three chapters how God commanded him to marry a woman who would subsequently become a prostitute. And the devastating emotions that this man experienced as a result of the unfaithfulness of his wife Gomer, who bore him a legitimate son, but then bore two illegitimate children, a daughter and a second son. But then, according to chapters 4 through 14, we as the reader come to an understanding why God wanted him to do this. And the reason was that God wanted Hosea to be able to identify with the way in which he felt over the unfaithfulness of his wife Israel, who went after the gods and goddesses within the land of Canaan. So when we come to this chapter 11, in spite of the faithfulness of God to the marital vows that he entered into at the time of Mount Sinai, Israel continued to be unfaithful to him as his wife. And we can see this clearly in the opening seven verses of this chapter 11. He's going to use the analogy here of father and son, but throughout the book he uses the analogy of husband and wife. But I want you to notice what we read in chapter 11, verse 1. When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they, these would be the prophets, called them, the more they, Israel, went from them. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. Yet it is I who taught Ephraim to walk, but took them in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of a man, with bonds of love, and I became to them as one who lifts the yoke from their jaws. And I bent down and fed them. They will not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria, he will be their king, because they refuse to return to me. And the sword will whirl against their cities and will demolish their gate bars and consume them because of their counsels. So my people are bent on turning from me, though they call them to the one on high, none at all exalts him. And then in an unbelievable verse that describes turmoil actually taking place within the heart of God himself, it is a verse couched in anthropopathic language. If you think of the word anthropomorphic or anthropomorphism, that is coming to God and trying to describe God in human terms. We know God is spirit, and yet we read that he has an ear or an eye or an arm or fingers. This is anthropomorphic language. But anthropopathic language is trying to describe God by way of human emotions. That's anthropopathism. And that is what we have here when we come into verse 8. And he does this because writer wants us to understand how God felt over the unfaithfulness of his wife, in spite of all of the things that he had done for her through centuries, as you read about in the Old Testament. He wants us to grasp something of how he felt. So when we come to this eighth verse, which is anthropopathic as you read it, we are confronted with four questions. And the questions are questions that God is asking himself. So I want you to notice it in the eighth verse. And this is God speaking. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I surrender you, Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart is turned over within me. This is God speaking. All my compassions are kindled. They are aroused. Now, when you read this statement and these four questions, and I read of Ephraim and Israel, obviously those are two terms being used interchangeably for the northern kingdom of Israel. So if I think of Ephraim, Israel, I'm thinking of one and the same. I'm thinking of the 10 tribes up in the north. I'm thinking about the northern kingdom. And the northern kingdom oftentimes referred to as Ephraim. So I read the statement here in terms of these questions. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I surrender you, Israel? And then the last two questions we read, how can I treat you like Admah? And how can I treat you like Zeboim? Now you read that and you say, well, I wonder what the writer means when he talks about Admah and Zeboim. And a concordance, of course, just a basic concordance would answer the question. If you remember in the book of Genesis, when you're reading the genealogies of these three sons, in Genesis chapter 10, Noah's three sons, you read of the genealogy of Ham. And in the midst of Genesis chapter 10, we read these words for the first time. We read of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim. And we read this in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 19. Or as you recall, if you come to Genesis chapter 14, we again read of these terms. In the second verse of chapter 14, for example, we read of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim, and then we read of Zoar. So when you think about Admah and Zeboim, these were two of five cities that formed a pentapolis in the vicinity of the Dead Sea. Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Zoar. God utterly destroyed four of them. He destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim. He did not destroy Zoar simply because Lot pleaded with him not to do it in Genesis chapter 19. It is the only reason why Zoar was spared. But Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim were obliterated. And you read Moses' description of this in Deuteronomy chapter 29. And if I'm reading Genesis, Deuteronomy chapter 29, I'm reading this in verse 23 as he describes what happened. And he writes of the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 23. So I'm reading these four questions that God is asking himself in verse 8 of this 11th chapter. Look at it again. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I surrender you, Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? And then we read, my heart, this is God speaking, my heart is turned over within me. All my compassions are kindled. They are aroused. So you're reading this and think about what God is saying. And he's saying this to himself. My justice, my righteousness, my holiness say, destroy Israel. Destroy Israel as you destroyed Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim. But my covenant love, my covenant loyalty says, no, don't destroy them, spare them. So you have this turmoil in anthropopathic language taking place within the heart of God himself concerning what he was going to do with reference to Israel. So I'm reading the statement here in this eighth verse, and you can sense the turmoil within God. As I read it, my heart is turned over within me. All my compassions are aroused, kindled. Then we come to verse 9, and verse 9 reads, I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not turn and devastate Ephraim, for I'm God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. Now that's what we read in verse 9. And God identifies himself as the Holy One in your midst. Or if you look at the end of verse 12, he is the Holy One. And we oftentimes read that in the Old Testament. In the Psalms, David will oftentimes say that God is the Holy One of Israel. Ezekiel will say that God is the Holy One in Israel. Habakkuk addresses him as my Holy One. Isaiah, at least 29 times in his book, refers to him as the Holy One of Israel. But here, as you're reading the words of Hosea, Hosea simply describes him as the Holy One in your midst. As I read it there in verse 9, I'm God, not man, the Holy One in your midst. So if I think of his holiness, I'm thinking about who God is and what he is like. Holiness in God sets him apart from everything that would be sinful, everything that would elevate sinful creation. He is absolutely against it. So if you think of the holiness of God, you have to think of the fact he is set apart from anything that is sinful, certainly from anything in the sinful creation as we have it. And oftentimes when I think of God's holiness, I think of the imagery of light as it's used in the Old Testament, because the imagery of light is oftentimes in connection with his holiness. Light dispels darkness. Light reveals all that darkness tries to conceal. And I read that God is light. God dwells in unapproachable light. God covers himself with light as with a garment. God is a consuming fire. So you're thinking about all of this in terms of God. So as I read this, and I'm reading this statement here, and what God says, I am God, not man, the Holy One in your midst. And yet, I'm thinking about Israel and the sinfulness of Israel. I know what happened to Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim because of their sinfulness. They were obliterated. They were destroyed. And then God is in this turmoil within himself concerning Israel and the sinfulness of Israel. And he's holy. He's absolutely holy. And Israel is anything but that. I think of the words of Habakkuk. In Habakkuk chapter 1 And Habakkuk simply, if I'm reading the book of Habakkuk chapter 1, I'll read this statement in verse 13. Thou art a pure eyes than to behold evil. He is a pure eyes that he can never look upon evil with any kind of favor. So I think about his holiness, and then I think about my unholiness and my sinfulness, and I raise the question, how could he spare Israel or spare us when he didn't spare Sodom, Gomorrah, Admon, Zeboim? Now listen to the words of J.C. Ryle. He weighs in on this, and J.C. Ryle just makes this little point. The very animals whose smell is most offensive to us have no idea that they're offensive and are not offensive to one another. And man, fallen man, has just no idea what a vile thing sin is in the sight of God. We just don't understand our sinfulness, and we don't really understand anything about his holiness. But when you read the statement here, and you come to verse 9, he definitively says three times he's not going to do it. Three times he says it. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not destroy Ephraim. I am God, not man, the Holy One in your midst. I will not come in wrath. I will not, I will not, I will not. He definitively says, I'm not going to destroy them. I destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, Admon, and Zeboim. I'm not going to destroy them. And yet he says he's holy. He's not man, because within ourselves, we would destroy them. But he's not man. He's God. And yet, as God, he's going to maintain his holiness and yet not do it. And that raises all kinds of questions within our minds. And it raises a fundamental problem. I mean, how can God say that? I see the turmoil within him. I'm reading the words in verse 8. And I read what he definitively says in verse 9. And there's a question that's raised in my mind that goes unanswered here. There's no answer here. He just simply says, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to destroy them. And he gives us his reason. I'm God, not man, the Holy One in your midst. So I'm not going to come in this anger. I'm not going to devastate Ephraim. I'm not going to come in wrath. So how do we resolve that problem and answer that question? How can God say this? I read this 2 weeks ago. In Job's question, when Job raises that question in Job 9, and in Job 9, verse 2, we read Job's question. Truly I know that it is so, but how can Enosh, how can weak, sickly man be tzedek? How can he be just righteous before God? And the question that Job asked is the same question that Bildad asked in Job 25, verse 4. How then can man, Enosh, weak, sickly man, be righteous before God? And how can he who is born of a woman be clean? And then we read in verse 25 of Job 25, but even the moon is not bright and the stars are not clean in his sight. How much less Enosh, weak, sickly man, a maggot, and the son of man, who is a worm. And those, as you remember, are simply symbols of corruption and decay and symbols of insignificance. So this is the problem. It is the problem that lingers in the pages of the Old Testament. And these are questions that simply are not answered in the pages of the Old Testament. How can a holy God not utterly destroy a people who are sinful? How can an unrighteous, unclean person ever be righteous or clean before a righteous, holy God? And we say that because we all recognize that our fundamental problem is our sinfulness. Our fundamental problem is our sin. We call it a number of things. We call it a sin nature. We call it inherited sin, and we call it original sin. And we call it original sin because it is something that is derived from our origin. And it focuses upon the reality of our sinfulness. So the assertion of original sin basically says, this is something that marks everyone from conception. This is something that is prior to any actual sin. There's an inner sinfulness which is at the root and source of all actual sins. It is something that is derived in a very real and yet extremely mysterious way from Adam. And original sin basically says that we are not sinners because we sin, but we sin because we're sinners. We have this sin nature. We have this inherited sin. We have this original sin that enslaves us, holds us in bondage to our own sin. So I think about all of this in terms of inherited sin, sin nature, original sin, and all of us are in the same situation. So I want you to go back with me to the book of Genesis, and I want you to notice something in Genesis chapter 1. This is Genesis chapter 1. And I want you to notice what we read in terms of what makes us as humans unique. And that, of course, would be we've been created in the image and likeness of God. Now notice Genesis 1 verse 26. And God said, let's make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male, female, he created them. Now that is what makes us unique. We've been created in the image and likeness of God, male and female. Then you come to Genesis chapter 2. And we read about the man, and the man placed in the garden. And we read this statement in verse 16 of Genesis 2. And the Lord God commanded the man, verse 16, saying, from every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat. So he has this bountiful banquet that man can partake of. Well, there's one prohibition, only one. Verse 17. But from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat from it. For in the day you eat from it, you shall surely die. And the Hebrew reads, dying you will die. So there's this banquet table he can feast upon with one prohibition. And if you violate the prohibition, dying, you will die. Then you come to chapter 3, after he creates the woman from the man. And you come into chapter 3, and we're introduced to this serpent. And we read what he says to the woman in verse 4. And the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. Takes the exact same phrase God uses and denies it. Dying, you will die. He absolutely says it won't happen. Then I read in verse 5. God does know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So the statement from the serpent is, you're not going to die, your eyes are going to be open, and you're going to become like God. So you read verse 6. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took from the fruit thereof, did eat, gave also to her husband with her, he was standing right there, and he did eat. And then we read this, verse 7, and the eyes of them both were opened. He said to them, the serpent said, your eyes will be opened. And it happened. Their eyes were opened. That's what it says. He also said that you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. And when I'm reading through Genesis chapter 3 and I'm reading verse 22, behold, the man has become like one of us to know good and evil. But what God knows intuitively, man is now going to understand and know experientially. And in his experience, he's going to be enslaved to that which is evil. He's going to be in bondage to sin and all the misery and pain and sorrow and heartache that go with it. So their eyes were opened. They became like God in a certain way, but now they're enslaved to evil. And then we read verse 7, when their eyes were opened, they knew that they were naked. So now there's something going on within them, and now they're trying to conceal and hide and run away. Now remember what the devil said in the fourth verse. You shall not surely die. But the moment they partook of the fruit, they died. They died. They died how? They died spiritually. They were alienated, estranged from God, even though Adam lived to be 930. The moment they ate, they were alienated from God. And now they're plunged into all kinds of problems. When we come to chapter 4, and we read of the woman conceiving and giving birth to the son, now you have the first fratricide that is described in the Bible, where a brother brutally slaughters his own brother. And that is what we have in chapter 4. But then we come to chapter 5, and I want you to notice what we read in the opening verses. This is the book of the generations of Adam, the man. In the day that God created man, in the likeness of God made he him. Male and female he created them, and blessed them, and called their name Adam, in the day when they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and he begat a son in his own likeness, after his image, and called his name Seth. So now you're talking about how sin is passed down from generation to generation. Now we're talking about the sin nature. Now we're talking about inherited sin. Now we're talking about original sin. And it's going all the way back to the origin, Adam and Eve. It's going right back to them. There's a connection between Adam and the entire human race. And all of the Bible sets it forth. Let me just read a couple of statements. Listen to Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 29. God made man upright, but they've sold out many schemes. Ecclesiastes 7:29. Listen to the words of Hosea, and listen to Hosea chapter 6, verse 7. But they, like Adam, have transgressed the agreement. They, like Adam, have transgressed the agreement. Hosea chapter 6 and verse 7. Listen to Acts chapter 17, verse 26. When Paul says, God made from one man, Adam, all nations of men. So there is a connection that exists between Adam and the human race. And inherited sin is all about spiritual death, being alienated from him, estranged from him, which is universal to the human race. Now, I read a very interesting article and a very disturbing article about gene editing and editing human embryos, this CRISPR. And you think about changing DNA and doing all of this, modifying this. In the United States, it's prohibited. 70 other countries, it's prohibited. You can't do this. But there was a Chinese scientist who did it, and did it back in 2018. And it was basically with three children, the twins, and then there was another child that was born. And he manipulated the DNA in terms of this embryo. And it's interesting to read it because the China state-run media celebrated the news, at least at the beginning of it, but the scientific community had reacted with such horror because they recognized this Chinese scientist opened this Pandora box that they withdrew their enthusiasm. And then when he returned, this scientist, to the mainland, his lab was locked. He was placed under house arrest. And in 2019, he was sentenced to 3 years in prison for illegal medical practices and fined nearly $500,000. So from 2019 to 2022, he was in prison. He was released in 2022. You know what he's doing now? He's in Wuhan. He's the director of the Institute of Genetic Medicine in Wuhan. Now, you can talk about editing whatever, and you can talk about editing DNA and all of that, but you can never delete sin. Every individual born in sin. It is absolutely pervasive. So when we talk about this, we have to recognize and understand this is something that we have from conception. It is something that can never be edited out. It is not something that is acquired. It is something that affects every facet of our being, our mind, our emotions, and our will. Our intellect and our understanding are blinded and darkened. Our emotions are degraded and defiled. Our wills are in bondage. They're enslaved to sin. So that every individual, every unsaved person is enslaved to sin and stands in opposition to God. That's true of every individual. So think about sin. If I think about sin, wouldn't we say that sin is all about I, me, my? Wouldn't we say that sin is selfishness? Everything revolves around me, my self-sufficiency, my independence. I mean, what does a small child say? I can do it. Let me do it. That's mine. There's a preoccupation. There's an obsession with self, selfishness, independence. I think of Henley's words in that poem, Invictus. I'm the master of my fate. I'm the captain of my soul. I can still think about Frank Sinatra singing, I can do it my way. I mean, that's sin. It's all selfish. It's all about me. And it's endemic to the human race. So just think about it. There was an apocryphal individual by the name of Mr. Titcomb. And Mr. Titcomb could wear glasses. And if he wore these glasses, he could see what was going on in the mind and heart of every individual. Just think about if we could wear Mr. Tidcombe's glasses and we could look out and see what everyone's thinking about at every moment of time. I think we would be terrified. We'd be terrified about one another. We'd be fleeing and hiding. I mean, just think about it. It's sinful. It's the sinfulness of the human race. So I think about all of this and I recognize we all stand in opposition to God. And it's interesting what individuals have said about sin. The late John Stott writes, sin is an unpopular subject and Christians are often criticized for harping on it too much. But it's only because Christians are realists that they do so. Sin is not a convenient invention of parsons to keep them in their job. It's a fact of human experience. Or I think of the words of G.K. Chesterton who said, new theologians dispute original sin, which is the only part of Christian theology which can really be proved. They admit divine sinlessness, but they essentially deny human sin, which they can see out in the street. You see it everywhere in terms of sinfulness. Or I think about that correspondent of the London Times. He researching and reporting all of the problems of his day that are very similar to the problems that we face in our day, ended every article with the statement, "What's wrong with the world? What's wrong with the world?" And G.K. Chesterton wrote that reply, "Dear editor, what's wrong with the world? I am. Faithfully yours, G.K. Chesterton." The problem of the world is the sinfulness of man, the sinfulness of the human race. That's the problem. And every individual, every unsaved individual stands in opposition to him, an enemy to him. In the words of C.S. Lewis, "We're not merely imperfect creatures who must be improved. We are rebels who must lay down our arms." So this is the problem. It's a problem that confronts the entire human race. It raises all kinds of questions. How can someone who is unrighteous and sinful ever be righteous and sinless before a God, since all of us are unrighteous and sinful? How can God, who is utterly other, he's absolutely holy, how can he not consume? How can he not destroy those who are not holy? I mean, those are fundamental questions. Or I'm reading Hosea chapter 11, and I understand what God is saying, and he says, "I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to do it, I'm not going to do it, and I'm going to maintain my holiness and not doing it." And then I read those questions of Job. Job 9 and Job 25. How can a man be just with God? Now, if you read that Job 9, if you remember, when you come towards the end of that chapter in Job 9, there's a little statement that Job makes. And he says in verse 33, "There's no umpire between us who may lay his hand upon us both." There's no umpire. Job says, there's no one that can lay his hand upon God and him and bring them together. There's no umpire between us, Job and God, who may lay his hand upon us both. But there is. And we know him, of course, as Jesus Christ. And this is what Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And I want you to listen to his statement because it's the very same word. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 5, the Apostle Paul says, "There is one God and one umpire." There's only one mesetes. It's the same word. There is only one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. He's the umpire. He can lay his hand upon God and us because he became the God-man. So I'm reading the statement here. There's one God and one go-between, one umpire, one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself a ransom for all. The only way that we can ever have a relationship with God is through Jesus Christ and what Jesus Christ did. That's the only way.